Good morning, everyone. Good morning. It's good to be gathered. And we are continuing a chapel series that engages with our common read this year, Between the World and Me. And the title of this presentation is Hope and History in King, Obama, and Coates. Does the arc of history really bend toward justice, as King and Obama like to say? Think theologically about hope and history this morning as part of the Common Read Chapel series on Between the World and Me. And we'll be hearing from Peter Dula, Associate Professor of Religion and Culture. Peter received his PhD from Duke University in Theology and Ethics in 2004. He's the author of Cavell, Companionship and Christian Theology, published by Oxford in 2011. And before coming to EMU in 2006, he was the Mennonite Central Committee Iraq Program Coordinator. He's taught at Lancaster Mennonite High School and at the Meserete Christos College in Ethiopia, where he was a Fulbright Scholar in 2001 to 2002. He's received several grants and fellowships, including most recently the Louisville Institute Sabbatical Grant for Researchers. Most of us know him for the quality of who he is, his character, and his teaching here among us. And we're grateful, Peter, for you developing this presentation today. We'll open with singing and then a scripture passage selected by Peter, and then he's here to engage with us.
Let's stand and sing number 33 in the Sing the Storybook. Number 33. I'm going to sing verses 2 and 5, and you can sing with me if you like, but we'll all join in on the refrain, and we'll begin with the refrain. Thank you.
Amos 5:18-20, the day of the Lord. Woe to you who long for the day of the Lord. Why do you long for the day of the Lord? That day will be darkness, not light. It will be as though you fled from a lion, only to meet a bear. As though you entered your house and rested your hand on the wall, only to have the snake bite it. Will not the day of the Lord be darkness and not light? Pitch dark without a ray of brightness. Amos 5:23-24. Away with the noise of your songs. I will not listen to the music of your harps, but let justice roll on like a river, righteousness like a never-failing stream.
Amos 9:11-15. In that day, I will restore David's fallen shelter. I will repair its broken walls and restore its ruins and rebuild it as it used to be, so that they may possess the remnants of Edom and all the nations that bear my name, declares the Lord, who will do all these things. The days are coming, declares the Lord, when the reaper will be overtaken by the plowman and the planter by the one treading grapes. New wine will drip from the mountains and flow from all the hills, and I will bring my people Israel back from exile. They will rebuild the ruined cities and live in them. They will plant vineyards and drink their wine. They will make gardens and eat their fruit. I will plant Israel in their own land, never again to be uprooted from the land I have given them, says the Lord your God.
Thank you, Maya and Skylar, for doing that and doing it kind of last minute. And Perry for the song. And thank you all for coming. Thank you, Brian, for the invitation. Brian asked me to speak in chapel occasionally, and about once every 8 years, I forget to say no. So, before I start, a quick sort of plug for Friday's chapel. Friday is the MIP chapel, the Ministry Inquiry Program chapel. So you can come here to hear Caleb Schrockhurst, Elizabeth Whitmer, and Maddie List, Skylar's sister, will also be here on video. So please come back, and everybody bring a friend. Yeah? Okay. This is the Oval Office rug in George W. Bush's White House. Each president gets to design their own rug. Bush got First Lady Laura to design this rug. He liked to talk about it as symbolizing how optimistic he is, right? So you have the light of the sun's rays projecting out of the American eagle. Kind of reminds me of this. This should make a good rug. In the Oval Office of the tribe of some worshippers of some primitive sun god. I am not really interested in George Bush's rug or this logo, but I wanted some levity before it starts to get really serious up here. I'm more interested in this rug. This is Barack Obama's Oval Office rug. The part that interests me is here and here. So around the perimeter of Obama's rug, he had a number of quotations. And this is a quotation he attributed to Martin Luther King Jr. back here. Yeah, you can't see it, I know. It says, arc of the moral universe bends toward justice. Some of you may follow Pete Souza on Instagram. He's the guy who did the big coffee table Obama book that was sold out on Amazon like week before Christmas. He Instagrammed this last Monday on Martin Luther King Jr. Day. And I don't know if, I don't know if you can read that, but as the end of that quote, bends towards justice. It was a very important quote for King. He said it repeatedly in multiple sermons. It is inscribed at his memorial in D.C. But it's actually a quotation from a 19th century preacher named Theodore Parker. This is his original version. I heard Desmond Tutu recite the same quote when he got an award at the Gandhi Center like 10 years ago. And here's Ta-Nehisi Coates' version of it. This is early in Between the World and Me, and it's how he kind of marks out his territory in contrast to the others. Here's all four of them. We're going to talk about them. When I was here yesterday, I thought I could read it from like back where Kevin and Lana are. I don't know if you can read it all the way in the back, but so there's four different quotes here, all circling around that quotation in their own ways. I think Coates has issues with all three of the others. I think he's right about Parker's and Obama's, and paying attention to how he's right might help us untangle Christian hope from their versions of hope, or untangle good theology from bad. I think he also has issues with King's version. I'm not as immediately sympathetic with those, but I think they're instructive. I'll try to say how. So let's start with Parker. Parker's is in the red. He was a 19th century abolitionist preacher who got kicked out of the Unitarian Church because of his skepticism about the Bible. That shows how long ago that was, that you get kicked out of the Unitarian Church. I appreciate his modesty about the ark, right? That his acknowledgement that he can't see it, in tension with his assurance that he can divine it by conscience. But I can imagine Coates reading this and just being bewildered. You divine it by conscience? You're just making that up. I'm sympathetic with Coates here. If there is such an arc, and if it bends the way Parker thinks it does, I don't think it can be simply read off history. I think it would have to be known by what theologians call revelation. Obama's version at the top, this is from his speech the night he won in 2008, is distinctly different, right? He turns it into a statement about history, not the moral universe, but I don't think that's a bad translation, partly because I don't really know what the moral universe is. But the mysteriousness that pervades Parker's version is gone. And unlike Parker, Obama seems to think it can be read off of history. Not only that, it's something in our control. Not only can we see it, we can help it bend. And those of us who voted for him 9 years ago participated in bending it. We, the people, are the answer. Of course, you can't help but feel a little bit here that the we is becoming a euphemism for me. I think Obama's version is the central target of Coates. I have found it useful to think of Between the World and Me as a kind of companion counter-volume to Obama's memoir, Dreams of My Father. Both the coming-of-age stories of young black men coming to terms with race in America by becoming writers. But they end up in very different places. Not just in his memoir, but in speech after speech, Obama presents his story, his rise from childhood poverty to Harvard Law Review to the presidency, as evidence that racism is not essential to the American story, to what Coates calls the dream. Racism for Obama is not inscribed at the founding. In Obama's version of the story, America is founded on the conviction that all humans are created free and equal, and deserve an equal share of power and governance. American history, then, is the story of progressively making that vision a reality by overcoming the obstacles of slavery, patriarchy, etc. And he identifies that progress with history's arc. For Coates, on the other hand, Obama's American creed of liberty and equality does not exist alongside slavery and the genocidal dispossession of Native Americans. It rests, as it were, on top of them. The distinction's absolutely essential to understanding the difference between Coates and Obama, between liberalism and radicalism. Liberty and equality enjoyed by whiteness did not exist in spite of the oppression of people of color, but because of it. I'm not going to try to tell you who's right in this debate, Coates or Obama. My own story as the son of a white woman and an African man has far more parallels with Obama's than Coates' story. Not that many, but you know what I mean. More than you might think. But my historical and philosophical commitments place me with Coates. I don't think the arc of history bends towards justice. I also don't think it bends towards chaos. I don't think history has an arc. I think history has thousands of arcs. Some of them have bent asymptotically toward justice. Some of them haven't. Some of them look like they did and then crashed and burned and vice versa. But where do my theological commitments place me? Doesn't the Bible make repeated claims about an arc of history bending toward justice? Didn't Schuyler just read us one of them? Didn't we just sing a mashup of three or four different versions of them? Doesn't the Bible from beginning to end, from the promises to Abraham and then to Moses, up through the prophets all the way to John's apocalypse, repeatedly and consistently understand history as the field upon which God's purposes are enacted, culminated in a time when they are decisively disclosed? Well, yeah. But I think the better way to say it is that the arc of God's purposes in history bend toward justice, if you'll grant me that distinction. So here I want to turn at last to the King quotation. This is the long one, the blue one. It is from his statement after they won the Montgomery bus boycott. I want to point out something that places it in contrast to Parker's and Obama's and in the company of the prophetic voices Maya and Schuyler read. One thing that's immediately obvious, perhaps most obvious, is King's ability to constantly keep hope and despair in tension. Like almost every page of the prophets, King never relaxes this tension, the tension between the passage Maya read and the passage Schuyler read. Success and failure, light and dark, cross and resurrection, Friday and Sunday are always held together. He put it most famously and pithily when he said, "We must hew a stone of hope out of the mountain of despair." A line that comes right after he quotes the Parker speech again 11 years later in 1967. He does this over and over again. It seems to me it's one of his most characteristic ways of speaking. The arc of God's purposes in history, he seems to say, bends toward the cross. He never lets resurrection crowd out the cross. For the cross crowd out resurrection, he's situated firmly in Holy Saturday. Now, most often in Between the World and Me, Coates seems to understand even King's hope as a false hope. But what interests me is that Coates never makes the sort of easy, conventional, common criticism of Christian hope that, you know, if God is in control, then humanity is relieved of responsibility, that God's guarantee of the future means we don't have to worry about it. He doesn't make the political critique of Christian hope. It seems to me he makes a psychological critique. So in contrast to the false hopes and blind faiths of white, black, and Christian dreams, Coates offers questioning. Here he is describing his education at Howard. "I began to see discord, argument, chaos, perhaps even fear as a kind of power. I was learning to live in the disquiet I felt in the library, in the mess of my mind, the gnawing discomfort, the chaos, the intellectual vertigo was not an alarm, it was a beacon." I think those three sentences should be carved in granite above the entrance to every university library in the U.S. I think they should be emblazoned on the cover of each EMU first year's orientation folder. I think this is at the heart of Coates' rejection of all kinds of hope. He thinks Christian hope is a way of avoiding discord, argument, chaos. And if he loses that, he loses what he calls a kind of power, a writer's kind of power. He loses his beacon. For him, such discord is the pulsing energy at the heart of his existence. And to trade in those questions for Christian answers would be a kind of death. So we may be surprised, but shouldn't be, when towards the end of the book, Coates turns that questioning eye on his own relationship to the church. In the third and final section of the book, he reaches out to the mother of Prince Jones, his friend from Howard, killed like so many other innocent black men by the police. Reflecting on his impressions of her, he writes, "I thought of my own distance from the black church that has so often been the only support for our people. I often wonder if in that distance I've missed something, some notions of cosmic hope, some wisdom beyond my mean physical perception of the world, something beyond the body that I might have transmitted to you. I wondered this at that particular moment because something beyond everything I have ever understood drove Mabel Jones to an exceptional life." So here, 10 pages from the end of the book, Coates starts to revise the remarks behind me. He takes back the part about retreat, realizing that the church may not necessarily be a political or a psychological escape. Here it's narrated as the exact opposite, as something that pushed Mabel Jones into the world and not away from it, into her own kind of disquiet. Here, 10 pages from the end, he also questions his own materialism. Moreover, his encounter with Mrs. Jones also prompts a revision of his early disdain for the civil rights movement's nonviolence. Gazing at her, he says, reminds him of the picture from the sit-ins in the 1960s. He says, "Have you ever looked at those faces? The faces are neither angry, nor sad, nor joyous. They betray almost no emotion. They look out past their tormentors, past us, and focus on something way beyond anything known to me. I think they are fastened to their God. God whom I cannot know and in whom I do not believe, but God or not, the armor is all over them and it's real." If you or I here as Christians hear that change in tone with a sigh of relief, whew, he's let us off the hook for some of the crazy things we believe, we have entirely missed the point. The point, rather, is this. We, or at least many of us, are to come to Coates the way Coates comes to Mabel Jones, allowing him to draw us into questioning our most fundamental convictions. Not to abandon them or disown them, but to rethink them. James Baldwin wrote, and I'm about to end, "The purpose of art is to lay bare the questions that have been hidden by the answers. It's also the purpose of theology. The arc of history doesn't exist. The arc of God's purposes does, and it bends toward justice. But justice is an abstraction. We can be more precise. The arc of God's purposes in history bends toward the cross." That sounds like an answer, but it's an answer that lays bare a host of questions. How is that justice? How does that fulfill the promises read by Schuyler? Shall we understand those promises to have been revealed as metaphors for the cross? And if so, should we also think of the second coming is equally metaphorical, but of a mystery we cannot understand rather than a future firmly in our intellectual grasp. I don't know about you, but those questions provoke in me exactly what I imagine Coates means by intellectual vertigo. Thank you.
Let's sing number 372 in the blue hymnal. Number 372, and let's stand together. And if you feel so inclined, keep the beat somewhere on you, in your chest, on the pew, on the floor. Sing together, O Healing River.
Challenging word, this comparative that's been brought before us today. If you're not talking about Between the World and Me, let's talk about these themes. If you haven't read it yet, get it and read it. It's the common read, and it's only common if, yes, you get it. Go adequately disturbed and engaged and activated.